Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we take the chaotic flow of current events, politics, and breaking news, and, well, try to make some sense of it for you.
And if you felt like you had whiplash from the headlines this week, you are definitely not alone.
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, it was just one thing after another.
That's right. The sources we synthesized for this deep dive, they really paint an extraordinary picture of simultaneous crises. It wasn't just a busy week.
Yeah.
It was a period of intense political compression. I mean, the U.S. administration was getting hit from all sides, legal, economic, and maybe most surprisingly, from within its own party.
It really feels less like governing and more like just constant political firefighting.
Political whiplash is a good way to put it.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
We're going to act as your guides through this political minefield. Our goal is really to connect the crucial dots between the biggest stories.
From, you know, internal party civil wars to major policy reversals and some really high stakes global diplomacy.
Exactly. So you can walk away understanding the true implications of it all. And as always, we're staying strictly neutral here, focusing only on the analysis from the source material we've gathered.
Okay, so we've organized this into four major pressure points. First, we're going to unpack monumental drama around the Jeffrey Epstein file releases.
Which has triggered just an unprecedented civil war inside the Republican Party. It's really something to see.
Oh, absolutely. Then second, we'll shift over to the economy. We'll analyze this dramatic collapse in approval on inflation and the policy reversal that came right after the sudden rollback of tariffs.
Then we're going to tackle the legal landscape. We've got some pretty dramatic shifts in the Georgia election interference case. We'll talk about the limits of presidential pardons and that staggering multi-billion dollar legal threat President Trump has leveled at the BBC.
And finally, we'll look globally. Major security and international policy moves. We're talking about an F-35 jet deal for Saudi Arabia, the new, very controversial designation of some foreign Antifa groups as terrorist organizations, and the pretty fraught negotiations happening at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil.
So let's unpack this chaotic week. And I think we have to start at the epicenter of the political storm, which was that document release.
The document release, yeah.
So the flashpoint, the thing that kicked this all off, was this massive document dump. The House Oversight Committee released over 20,000 pages of documents, all sourced from Jeffrey Epstein's estate.
And this wasn't just a trickle of information, you know, it was a deluge.
A complete deluge.
And it immediately put this intense, very uncomfortable scrutiny back on a lot of high-profile figures, and that includes President Trump.
Yeah, and this kind of document dump, it just instantly changes the political temperature, doesn't it?
Oh, completely. And the administration's response was, well, a masterclass in deflection and counterattack. President Trump, he first tried to just minimize the files. He stated flatly on Air Force One that he doesn't care about them.
Right.
And then he escalated this almost immediately on Truth Social, calling the whole release a hoax.
A hoax?
Yeah, a hoax orchestrated by Democrats just to distract the public from what he was calling the successful end to the government shutdown.
Which is classic counterpunching. But what's really fascinating here is the formal action that came next. I mean, he didn't just let the story fade. He ordered Attorney General Pam Bondi to open an investigation.
Exactly. But not into the files themselves, really. It was pointedly aimed at Democrats.
Uh-huh.
The mandate for the investigation was very specific. It's targeting Epstein's ties to prominent Democrats. And he specifically cited former President Bill Clinton and the LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman.
And the timing on this is just,
yeah.
It's everything, isn't it?
It's crucial. I mean, to order an investigation into your opponents right after documents referencing you, the current president, are released, it suggests a really calculated strategy. You shift the narrative. You deploy the power of the federal government to make sure the spotlight is somewhere else.
And Bondi's confirmed that investigation is moving forward.
It is.
Okay, so let's look at the uncomfortable details in the files themselves, especially the ones concerning the president. They don't seem to confirm any criminal wrongdoing, but they certainly imply a level of deep knowledge or at least association.
They absolutely raise significant red flags about awareness and character, according to the sources. I mean, one piece of correspondence that's being cited is an alleged email exchange from February 2017.
So this is just weeks into the administration.
Just weeks in. And it quotes Epstein in a conversation he was having with the former Treasury Secretary, Larry Summers. And the quote is just stark. It's personal. Epstein allegedly told Summers, and this is a direct quote, "Recall I've told you I have met some very bad people, none as bad as Trump. Not one decent cell in his body. So yes, dangerous."
Wow. That is an astonishing statement to be coming from a figure like Epstein. I mean, it suggests a really profound negative assessment of the sitting president, even while, you know, other people associated with him were working right inside the administration.
It's incredible.
Were there other entries in the files that suggested some kind of awareness?
Yes. Other emails alleged that Trump knew about the girls. This was in a note that was sent to the author, Michael Wolff, who, you know, is known for his critical books on the administration.
Right.
There was also a suggestion that Epstein may have even joined Trump for a Thanksgiving celebration while he was president. Now, these claims are, of course, consistently denied by the White House. They've characterized the revelations as an effort by liberal outlets to distract from other successes. But the very existence of these messages in the public domain, I mean, regardless of their accuracy, it just creates a huge political liability.
And this brings us to this investigative theory from the reporter Barry Levine, which it really dramatically changes how we should maybe interpret some of these communications.
Mm.
This theory suggests these emails weren't just simple documentation.
Right. This is where we move from just reporting into some real analysis. Levine's theory is that Epstein likely knew that law enforcement was closing in on him, especially after all that extensive coverage from the Miami Herald.
Huh.
The theory suggests Epstein engaged in this deliberate information strategy. He would send emails or memos to himself detailing his high-level connections. For example, there's one note mentioning Mar-a-Lago and claiming Trump knew of it and came to my house many times during that period.
So not for record keeping.
Not for truthful record keeping, no.
Yeah.
But as a form of leverage or maybe an insurance policy against a future arrest or prosecution.
So if that theory is true, it means we have to view every name mentioned, every alleged connection, through this lens of potential strategic manipulation.
Exactly. It makes the search for truth a lot more complicated, but it certainly helps explain the level of detail about all these high-profile figures.
But regardless of how you interpret it, the files created this instant political wildfire, and it just immediately consumed the loyalty structure of the entire MAGA movement.
And this is where we see just the most spectacular implosion of internal party unity in, I mean, recent memory, the feud between President Trump and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Who was, until this very moment, one of his most ardent and vocal defenders. It's a shocking split.
It is. And the split, it's confirmed by the sources, is explicitly and exclusively about these files, nothing else.
So what was it specifically that sent Representative Greene over the edge? What made her decide to challenge the president on this issue of all things?
Well, her actions were driven by this really sustained and aggressive public push for the full, unredacted release of all the Epstein files.
Not just the estate files.
No, specifically the ones held by the DOJ. And Green, she framed this as a matter of justice, a populist commitment. She argued publicly that the president should be fighting as hard for the forgotten men and women, meaning the victims of Epstein, as he seems to be fighting to stop the full files from coming out.
And she also questioned his priorities, right? She kind of went after his focus on foreign affairs.
He did, and that was a calculated risk. She criticized his recent focus on, you know, complex foreign policy over what she called domestic kitchen table concerns.
And Trump's reaction was,
yeah,
well, it was volcanic, immediate and utterly public.
It really was. He officially withdrew his endorsement for her reelection, which for any Republican in a primary, that is a devastating political blow.
It's a death sentence, politically.
It can be. And he didn't just withdraw support. He launched this series of just vicious personal attacks.
Yeah, the nicknames.
He deployed this brutal array of nicknames intended to just completely delegitimize her. He called her wacky, a ranting lunatic, and then he used that deeply cutting one, Marjorie Traitor Greene.
Traitor Greene.
And on top of that, he publicly stated that she had betrayed the entire Republican Party when she turned left on this. And he actively encouraged conservative challengers to run against her in the primary.
The level of vitriol against a sitting Republican who just weeks ago was one of his most loyal soldiers is, I mean, it's unprecedented in the modern GOP.
It really is. But MTG didn't back down.
No, she fired right back.
She did. She immediately went public, releasing text messages that she claimed, confirmed, that this whole Epstein file disagreement was the precise reason Trump went over the edge.
And in those texts, she seemed to be trying to walk a fine line.
She did. She acknowledged repeating the line from the victim's attorney that Trump himself did nothing wrong, but then she argued forcefully that the fact that victims were raped as teenagers is not a hoax.
Which is a direct contradiction of Trump's earlier dismissal of the files.
A direct shot. And the dispute, it then moved really quickly from just political insults to genuine safety concerns.
Right. She said she was getting death threats.
She did. She stated that she received death threats that were being fueled and egged on by Trump and his radical internet trolls.
And she made it personal.
Very personal. She made a point of saying that as a woman, she takes threats from men seriously. And she even compared her situation to the genuine fear that Epstein's victims must have felt. And that framing, it really shifted the political fight into a moral one, aligning her stance with the victims.
Now, this isn't just a political soap opera, right? This feud has had immediate real-world legislative consequences, which is a really important takeaway for you listening.
Absolutely. The fallout immediately impacted the functioning of the House of Representatives. Green joined forces with Representative Thomas Massey to push a discharge petition.
Okay, so let's break that down. For anyone who isn't a congressional procedure nerd, what exactly is a discharge petition?
It's a rarely used but extraordinarily powerful procedural tool. It basically allows a majority of members, 218 signatures, to circumvent the House leadership, bypass all the committees, and force an immediate floor vote on a specific piece of legislation.
So by getting those 218 signatures, they successfully stripped control away from Speaker Johnson and the entire House leadership on this one very politically volatile issue. What does that signal?
It signals a profound loss of control by the leadership. And it shows a fracture in the party so severe that a procedural coup, which is what this is, was successful. Speaker Johnson was essentially forced to concede. He said they might as well just do it, which is basically him admitting he'd lost control.
And the significance of this is massive.
It's huge because it forces every single member of the House next week to take a recorded public vote on whether to compel the DOJ to release the full unredacted files. This is political dynamite.
It really is. It forces members to choose between protecting their party loyalty and potentially aligning with this populist, though politically chaotic, call for transparency.
A very tough spot to be in.
And the stakes are being compared to some pretty major historical crises.
Yes, they are. Democratic Representative Melanie Stansbury, who's involved in the committee investigating Epstein, she did not shy away from the historical gravity of this. She asserted that this scandal, especially if the vote next week confirms a concerted cover-up, could be as explosive as Watergate.
Watergate, that's a heavy comparison.
It is, and she pointed specifically to the fact that the White House and the DOJ have consistently failed to comply with existing subpoenas for these full unredacted files. And that suggests, in her view, that Trump's recent order for Bondi to investigate Democrats is likely nothing more than a stalling tactic.
A way to buy time before this forced vote next week.
Exactly. Stansbury believes the administration's frantic pressure campaign on members of Congress about this vote is proof that they are actively engaged in a cover-up.
Okay, let's shift gears from that intense internal political warfare to the legal battles, because there were also major shifts happening on both state and federal fronts, starting with that complex and ever-evolving Georgia election interference case.
Yeah, the Georgia case against President Trump continues to be a moving target. It's so complicated by legal, jurisdictional, and now ethical factors. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee just delivered a really key ruling.
Dropping some of the charges.
Dropping three specific charges against Trump, yes. These counts related primarily to conspiracy and the criminal attempt to file false documents.
And why were those charges dropped? Was it a lack of evidence?
No, it was a legal technicality, actually. It was all about jurisdiction. Judge McAfee argued that the underlying actions cited in those specific charges, which included things like efforts to lobby state officials outside of Georgia, well, he argued they fell outside the legal jurisdiction of the state of Georgia.
Okay, so the prosecution can appeal that, but for now, it's a win for the defense.
It is. It immediately reduced the legal burden facing the former president.
So even with those three charges dropped, what's the current total status of the case against him in Georgia?
He still faces 32 state charges related to trying to overturn the election results. So it's still a very serious case. But this ruling came on the same day as an even more significant structural change for the prosecution team.
This is about DA Fani Willis.
Right. This followed the finalization of her disqualification, a decision that was made because of the revelation of her romantic relationship with the former special prosecutor. Judge McAfee ruled it created an unmanageable appearance of impropriety.
And that created this massive void in the prosecution team, right? A void that had to be filled immediately, or the whole case could have just collapsed.
Precisely. The situation was so urgent that Peter Skandalekas, who is the director of the Prosecuting Attorneys Council of Georgia, which is an independent body designed to support prosecutors, he appointed himself to lead the prosecution.
Wow. he appointed himself. That's an extraordinary move.
It really is.
It signals a deep institutional interest in making sure this case survives. Why did he personally have to step in?
Well, Skindalakis said that his organization just could not find another prosecutor willing or able to take on the massive burden of this case before Judge McAfee's deadline.
So it was either him or nothing.
It was. He was very clear. He said if a prosecutor hadn't been appointed, the judge would have had no choice but to dismiss all the charges, which Skandalakis noted would go against the public's legitimate interest in the outcome of the case. He's now reviewing just a mountain of evidence, 101 boxes of documents and an 8-terabyte hard drive.
An incredible amount of material. Okay, shifting to presidential action. We saw a huge wave of pardons this week, and they were explicitly aimed at allies who were involved in the 2020 election challenges.
Yes, President Trump announced pardons for over 70 individuals. These are people accused of seeking to overturn the 2020 election, including, you know, high-profile, longtime allies like Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, and Sidney Powell.
It was presented as a sort of reaffirmation of their loyalty.
And an attempt to neutralize federal legal threats against them.
Yeah, and it's really vital that we clarify for you, the listener, the critical limitations of a presidential pardon, especially since so many of these people are facing state-level charges.
That is the essential legal distinction to understand here. Presidential pardons apply only to federal charges.
So charges brought by the U.S. government.
Exactly. They have zero legal effect on state charges. So for allies like Rudy Giuliani, who is facing state charges in Arizona over the whole fake elector scheme, or any of the co-defendants in the Georgia case, this pardon is largely symbolic.
Right. Skandalakis, the new prosecutor in Georgia, he was quick to point that out.
He was. He reminded the public that the 14 other Georgia defendants, even if they're convicted, they cannot be pardoned by President Trump because those are state offenses. So this move is really a political gesture of support, but it offers very limited real-world legal protection in these state-level battles.
Okay, now let's pivot to an international legal threat. This one really underscores the tension between political power and media organizations. I'm talking about the vow to sue the BBC. The dollar amount alone is just staggering.
It's intended to be staggering. Trump vowed to pursue a defamation lawsuit against the BBC, seeking between $1 and $5 billion.
The billion to $5 billion.
And this threat, it all stems from a specific edited clip from a Panorama documentary that aired just days before the 2024 election.
So what exactly did this edit do? Why did it draw such a massive response?
Well, the issue was in the production. It was done by a third-party company, and they spliced together three different quotes that Trump delivered in his January 6th, 2021 speech.
And crucially, these quotes weren't from the same part of the speech.
Not at all. They were taken from two different sections delivered almost an hour apart. And by editing them together like that, the documentary created this false impression that Trump was issuing a direct, immediate call for violent action against the Capitol.
And they cut out a key line.
They cut out the key line where he specifically told his supporters he wanted them to demonstrate peacefully and patriotically.
So the clip just fundamentally misrepresented the context of his speech, which creates a legal issue. But if the BBC admitted fault, why are the sources suggesting a $5 billion lawsuit is even on the table? I mean, isn't an apology usually enough to mitigate damages?
That is exactly the right question to ask. And the BBC, through its chairman, Samir Shah, did apologize for what they called an error of judgment that created the impression of a direct call for violent action.
But they didn't accept the defamation claim.
No, they vehemently rejected the defamation claim and the compensation demand. And legal experts who are familiar with UK libel law, they suggest the $5 billion figure is entirely political. It's not based on any reasonable measure of damages in a defamation case.
So the lawsuit threat is less about actually collecting damages and more about establishing a political precedent or, you know, just exerting massive pressure on a key international media organization.
Precisely. Trump called the event corrupt and beyond fake. He's using the threat as a political weapon, and the controversy has already triggered very serious consequences within the UK media structure.
Right, people resigned over this.
They did. The fallout led directly to the resignation of the BBC Director General Tim Davey and the head of news Deborah Turnus. It was amid just intense criticism of their editorial oversight and accusations of institutional bias against the US president.
And even UK political leaders are unwilling to step in on the BBC's behalf.
That's right. When the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer was pressed on whether he would personally urge Trump to drop this massive legal threat, he just refused to take a stance.
Really?
Yeah, he limited his comment to just reiterating support for a strong and independent BBC, while adding that the broadcaster must get its house in order.
Which really shows you the immense political sensitivity of crossing the administration, even overseas.
It does, especially because the BBC is approaching some very politically sensitive negotiations about its royal charter, which expires in 2027. So the timing is terrible for them.
Okay, so if the Epstein files are causing this internal political crisis, the economy is the external pressure point that forced some immediate targeted policy action this week. And the sources are highlighting a just dramatic collapse in public approval of the administration's handling of inflation.
The data on this is simply staggering, and it really illustrates why the administration felt it had to change course on trade policy. We were looking at data provided by the analyst Harry Enten, and it highlights a devastating shift in voter perception.
So what were the numbers?
Just back in October 2024, the administration had a 9-point lead over its opponents on who Americans trusted more on inflation.
A 9-point lead. And now?
Now, in mid-November 2025, that standing has completely reversed. The administration is now 26 points underwater on net approval for inflation.
Wow, that is a 35-point swing in public confidence in just over a year.
It's a structural collapse, and it suggests that economic anxiety, driven by these relentlessly climbing prices, particularly for everyday goods, is the single biggest vulnerability they have.
And this connects directly to their recent election performance, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The disappointing Republican results in recent off-year elections, especially in places where Democrats successfully campaign on voter economic anxieties, they suggest that those polls might actually be underestimating the extent of the political damage from this inflation crisis.
Because people feel this immediately. It's in their pocketbooks. Every single time they go to the grocery store.
Every single time.
So given this enormous political pressure, we saw a very sudden and specific policy reversal this week. A rollback of certain tariffs via executive order.
Yeah, this was a clear, targeted political response to those voter pain points. President Trump signed an executive order reversing tariffs on a very specific list of widely consumed commodities, things that directly impact grocery bills and household costs.
So it was on the list.
It included beef, coffee, tropical fruits, tea, cocoa, spices, bananas, oranges, tomatoes, and even certain fertilizers.
That list is highly intentional. I mean, it targets daily consumer staples. And you can bet the Democrats were quick to seize on the political messaging of this reversal.
Oh, they were. They immediately framed this tariff rollback as an admission by the administration that its own tariff policies had actively harmed American households and contributed directly to raising consumer prices.
And did President Trump concede that point at all?
He did, sort of. When he was pressed on whether his tariffs had contributed to rising consumer prices, the sources note he conceded, I say they may in some cases, but he quickly tried to neutralize the impact by adding that, to a large extent, they've been borne by other countries.
So the reversal was immediately interpreted as this kind of panicked attempt to pivot to affordability after those recent electoral defeats.
That was the narrative, yes.
But the strategy wasn't just a rollback. I mean, at the same time, the administration executed this coordinated effort to deflect blame for high prices away from tariff policy and onto specific industries, particularly beef.
That's the defensive coordination, exactly. Alongside the tariff reversal, Trump ordered the DOJ to investigate major meatpacking companies, a lot of which are majority foreign-owned, for illicit collusion, price fixing, and price manipulation.
So the narrative shift was clear. Yeah. It's not our policy, it's these greedy corporations.
Precisely. The administration argued that these corporate entities, not the trade policy, were artificially inflating beef prices and jeopardizing the nation's food supply. So they positioned the administration as the defender of American ranchers and consumers against corporate greed.
Now, despite this very targeted reversal on things like coffee and beef, the administration is still vehemently defending its overall tariff strategy with this huge populist promise.
The proposed
tariff dividend.
This is the persistent political dream they're selling. Trump continues to suggest that the massive revenue collected from his broader tariff strategy could fund a direct dividend of at least $2,000 checks to most Americans sometime in 2026.
So a huge direct financial benefit from a policy that is, at the same time, being blamed for inflation. It's a bit of a contradiction.
It is.
And critics, they typically argue that direct payments, like stimulus checks, just make inflation worse by increasing demand without increasing supply.
Yeah.
So how did the administration try to differentiate this proposed dividend?
Trump argued that this dividend wouldn't worsen inflation because it is money earned from other countries, not made-up stimulus money. He characterized it as real money that comes from other countries and is therefore non-inflationary.
Which is a critical political maneuver. Hmm. He's trying to transform a trade policy tariffs into a direct financial entitlement for the consumer, making it seem different from traditional government spending.
Exactly. But the paradox remains. Tariffs are bad enough that you have to reverse them for coffee, but they're good enough to fund a massive check for everyone.
A paradox indeed. Yeah. Okay, let's move finally to the government shutdown resolution and the immediate healthcare debate that followed. Mm. After the longest shutdown in history, a resolution was finally signed.
Yes, the 43-day shutdown finally ended. It reversed the layoffs and it funded the government through January 30th. And this deal was crucial because it also secured funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, through September for over 42 million Americans.
But the focus immediately shifted to the looming expiration of the Enhanced Affordable Care Act, or ACA, premium tax credits. They're set to expire very soon.
And this is the next massive sticking point. These enhanced subsidies, they significantly lower health insurance costs for millions of Americans. But the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has repeatedly refused to guarantee a vote on extending them without demanding significant reforms first.
What's his argument?
He's publicly labeled the enhanced subsidies as an unreformed COVID-era boondoggle to insurance companies. Now, to get the shutdown deal done, Senate Majority Leader John Thune promised a floor vote in December. But the final outcome is highly uncertain, and the debate is getting very intense.
So what are the immediate and, potentially catastrophic consequences if these enhanced premium tax credits are just allowed to expire? We should probably explain the technical concept of risk pooling here.
That's essential. Health policy experts universally warn of a process known as adverse selection. Basically, when costs rise, it's generally the healthier, younger, or wealthier individuals who file fewer claims who will choose to drop their ACA plans.
So this exodus of low-risk, healthy people removes them from the overall risk pool.
Right. And when the healthy people leave the pool.
The premiums for everyone who's left, who are typically older, sicker individuals who desperately need the coverage, they have to spiral even higher to cover the costs of the remaining riskier population.
It's the dreaded death spiral effect. And on top of that, it severely harms the financial stability of hospitals, which then have to either negotiate directly with a growing pool of uninsured patients or just eat the costs of their care.
And the GOP is offering some alternative healthcare proposals if the subsidies do expire. Let's analyze those. First, there's Trump's idea of just sending money directly to Americans to buy insurance.
Right. This proposal is all about consumer control, but it has some significant legal and economic flaws. Critics note that unlike the current subsidies, which are tax-free, this cash payment would be subject to federal, state, and income taxes, which would immediately reduce its actual value.
And more critically, it seems to undermine the whole point of insurance pooling.
It does. By giving individuals cash instead of supporting the structured subsidy marketplace, it completely undercuts the cost-lowering benefits of pooling risk, and it fails to provide adequate protection against truly catastrophic costs.
Okay. And the second idea, this one from Senator Bill Cassidy, involves a pre-funded FSA.
Yeah, Cassidy proposed a pre-funded federal flexible spending account, or FSA, that eligible Americans could use to cover health expenses.
And what do experts say about that?
Well, they agree it might empower individuals with a greater sense of choice and control over their routine health spending. But they really emphasize that an FSA is a savings account. It's designed for predictable, minor expenses. It is not an adequate substitute for genuine, comprehensive insurance coverage against a catastrophic financial event, like a major medical crisis that results in a $50,000 hospital bill.
So insurance is fundamentally about protection against the unpredictable. Not just having a preloaded debit card for checkups.
Exactly.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the global stage and the significant international and security decisions made this week. We can begin with a massive potential defense deal in the Middle East that is already raising some very serious security concerns.
Yes, President Trump announced that his administration is actively considering a major arms deal, supplying Saudi Arabia with F-35 stealth fighter jets.
And the timing of this announcement was pretty pointed.
Very timely. It came just ahead of his planned hosting of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman next week, where defense and substantial economic agreements are expected to be the central topics of conversation.
And this deal is clearly tied to broader diplomatic efforts, but the security risks seem, immediate and highly controversial.
They are. The diplomatic goal is pretty straightforward. Trump reiterated his longstanding hope that Saudi Arabia would officially join the Abraham Accords.
Right, normalizing relations between Israel and this key Muslim-majority nation.
Exactly. But the security concern is coming directly from within the U.S. defense apparatus. A Pentagon intelligence report was cited in the sources, warning of the significant risk that China could acquire the highly sensitive F-35 technology if the sale goes through.
Okay, so why would the Pentagon fear Chinese acquisition if the jets are being sold to Saudi Arabia? What's the connection?
Well, the concern centers on security protocols, maintenance, and the potential for technological transfer or espionage related to the classified radar evading technology. Granting a major new ally access to the F-35, it requires deep trust and really robust security guarantees.
And the Pentagon evidently fears those guarantees are insufficient here.
That's the implication, yeah. Given the geopolitical complexity of the region and the history of technological leakage, it seems they have reservations. It really places a massive diplomatic prize directly against a major national security risk.
Okay, moving over to Southeast Asia, we saw a diplomatic resolution to a border dispute between two U.S. allies, Thailand and Cambodia.
Yeah, this was a subtle but important piece of diplomacy, following some renewed cross-border clashes and the temporary suspension of a peace pact between them. The U.S. had briefly paused its trade talks with Thailand,
sending a clear signal that regional instability could impact economic cooperation.
That's right. But the resolution came pretty quickly, allowing those trade talks to get back on track.
How did that happen?
Well, following a phone call between Trump and the Thai Prime Minister, Anutin Charnvirakul, Thailand announced that the trade talks would continue, separated entirely from the border issue. The Thai government spokesman confirmed that Trump explicitly stated the U.S. does not wish to interfere in the Thailand-Cambodia bilateral mechanisms.
And that was the assurance Thailand needed.
It was. It allowed the tariff negotiations, which are aimed at maintaining a 19% tariff on certain Thai products while exploring other adjustments, to move forward without the political complication of that border conflict.
All right, shifting now to a security development that has vast domestic implications. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's designation of foreign Antifa groups as terrorist organizations.
This is a major development, mainly because it leverages international law to impact domestic policy. Rubio designated Antifa Ost, a group active in Hungary, along with three other foreign groups based in Italy and Greece, as terrorist organizations.
And he framed this as being in accordance with a presidential memorandum, NSPM 7?
Yes. President Trump's National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, which is about purported domestic terrorists.
Okay, so this raises the critical question. Why does designating foreign Antifa groups matter for U.S. domestic politics if the domestic groups themselves have not been formally designated as terrorists?
This is the crucial legal pathway that the designation establishes. Legal experts immediately flagged that under existing U.S. material support laws, domestic groups can face serious charges for providing nonviolent acts of support.
Nonviolent acts. So things like what?
Things like message coordination, financial aid, or logistical planning, providing that to a designated foreign terrorist organization.
So civil rights lawyers are warning that the administration could use these foreign designations as a kind of clever workaround.
A workaround, exactly. To target domestic anti-fascist groups for nonviolent association with their European counterparts, it allows the administration to pursue groups the president has previously labeled a major terrorist organization without the difficult and potentially unconstitutional process of formally designating a domestic group as a terrorist entity.
And the specific designation of Antifa Ost in Hungary seems particularly contentious given the political context there.
Indeed. The Antifa Ost designation, it stems from their alleged aggressive response to a neo-Nazi Day of Honor rally that happened in Budapest in February 2023.
And sources noted the tension there.
They did. While the group is accused of violence, the designation is happening in the context of the Orbán government's aggressive crackdown on anti-fascist activists, compared to what's described as the kid gloves treatment often given to neo-Nazi demonstrators.
And Secretary Rubio framed the action quite dramatically.
He did. He claimed, quote, "Anarchist militants have waged terror campaigns in the United States and Europe, conspiring to undermine the foundations of Western civilization through their brutal attacks." And he promised more crackdowns on Antifa groups globally.
All right, finally, let's turn to the Global Climate Summit, COP30, which is currently underway in Belém, Brazil. The sources are describing this conference as a major stress test of the Paris Agreement.
It's a moment of truth, really. It's been a decade since Paris, and the stark reality is that global oil and gas production and emissions have actually increased, and the world has already officially breached the critical 1.5 degrees Celsius warming threshold.
And current projections are not good.
No. Under current policy trajectories, the world is still on track for 2.6 degrees of warming, which is catastrophic. Brazilian President Lula, the host, he's framed COP30 as the COP of truth, demanding leaders move beyond just rhetoric to binding action.
But despite the summit being held in the Amazon region and, you know, being backed by Lula's government, the atmosphere inside the Blue Zone seems fraught with hypocrisy and contradiction.
The contradictions are glaring. The Kick Polluters Out Coalition, they did a count and found an astonishing 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists had obtained access credentials to COP30.
1,600.
1,600. That means roughly one in every 25 participants is there to actively protect the fossil fuel industry. And while there's been major visibility and nonviolent protests from indigenous groups demanding meetings with Lula and revocation of decrees targeting their land, the implementation discussions on phasing out fuels are hitting the same major familiar roadblocks.
And that major roadblock, according to NGO analysis, it really centers on the resistance from the world's richest, most powerful nations.
Yes. There is intense skepticism about achieving a roadmap with any kind of binding commitments for a fossil fuel phase out. The sources confirm the main resistance is coming from the very nations projected to be major expanders of oil and gas production over the next decade.
And that includes the U.S.
It includes the U.S., Canada, Norway, and Australia. Together, they account for 70% of new planned oil and gas expansion. And these nations are resisting explicit language that calls for a hard phase out.
And for the U.S., this resistance is inherently political.
Well, it's directly linked to the massive financial backing the administration receives from the oil and gas industry.
And adding to all this difficulty is this chaotic logistical deadlock over who is even going to host the next conference, COP31.
This is just pure geopolitical brinkmanship. The two candidates, Australia and Turkey, are deadlocked in negotiations. Turkey has refused to yield, knowing that a failure to decide quickly would force the conference to default to Bonn, Germany, which is where the UNFCCC secretariat is housed.
And Germany doesn't really want to do it on short notice.
They've reluctantly said they would host, but organizing a major global conference of this size and complexity in just 6 months would severely diminish the summit. It could undermine the whole global effort at a time when speed is absolutely critical.
So we have completed a pretty extensive deep dive into an exceptionally complex and chaotic week. We saw the Epstein files rip open this deep structural wound in the GOP, forcing an unprecedented civil war that, you know, manifested in a procedural coup with that discharge petition.
We did. And we tracked the intense economic pressures of inflation, which triggered that targeted tariff reversal on consumer staples.
And we reviewed this complex policy landscape, the institutional struggle to keep the Georgia prosecution alive, that legal threat leveraged against a major international broadcaster, and the high-stakes global maneuvers from the F-35 sale to the legal implications of the Antifa terrorist designation.
And, you know, the pressure points are all completely interconnected. The administration is internally fighting a loyalty war over these politically toxic files, while at the same time scrambling to placate voters who are suffering from economic woes that are directly impacting their election results.
That's right. So what does this all mean for the future of U.S. economic policy? Let's leave you with the central paradox of this week's economic moves.
On the one hand, the administration is actively rolling back tariffs on widely consumed goods like coffee and beef. And by doing that, they're politically admitting that tariffs are, in fact, a tax on the American consumer that drives up prices.
Right. But at the very same time, they're promoting this fantasy of a tariff-funded $2,000 dividend for those exact same consumers.
It forces this political and economic tension that really defines the moment.
So how does the public, and for that matter, how does the administration ultimately reconcile this political admission of tariff-induced harm, the need to roll them back, with the political promise that tariffs can be the direct source of a massive personal financial benefit? That fundamental disconnect between the policy reality and the political promise is likely to define the entire debate over the future direction of U.S. trade policy.
A truly fascinating tension to consider as we close out this deep dive into a week of intense upheaval. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Stay well informed.